are now listening to part two of the Wally Walker podcast. Part one, which we posted last Friday, has most of his recruitment, his early years, how he got into basketball and the NBA. And then we're going to talk a little bit about his pro career and then post-pro career here on part two. And then the photo series kind of goes over all of the UVA stuff again with a different twist to it. I think you'll want to tune into this. And then also, if you haven't seen or heard, there is another Wally Walker roundtable discussion that we had on Monday on racial injustice, the police brutality, and the changes we want to see. And that includes Malcolm Brogdon, Ty Jerome, Jenny Busick, Wally Walker, obviously. We had Tate Frazier, and then Jason Williford, and we had, you know, we had a really lively discussion that's kind of, I mean, it was really, really interesting and eye-opening for, you know, sports podcasts for us to kind of, I want to say change. I mean, it would just be really hard for us not to talk about it, and it was. We wanted to address it, and we had a lot of the big Wahoo Nation alumni come out and just share, and it's really cool to see all these guys and want to share their understanding and their experiences with all of us. And I hope you take a look. We're not going to post the audio just yet. I think we wanted you guys to see it on YouTube, so search for us, Locker Room Access. And YouTube, will put the link in the description. And it's a relatively long roundtable discussion, but I think it's worth your time to listen and watch. So check that out. Again, we'll put that link in the description. Again, here's Wally Walker, part two. Enjoy.
You guys want to hear a Bill Russell Red Auerbach story going back?
Absolutely.
Oh yes, please.
So my years of running the front office in Seattle, I used to have Bill Russell come at least once a year, as much as he wanted to. But I would sit with him at a Sonics game, and would just ask him questions and just listen. He'd tell stories. So he told me a story about he and Red Auerbach when he is Bill Russell, and they did win 11 championships in his 13 years in Boston. And Red would say to him before every training camp, he'd say, "Rush, you know the deal. The first couple of days of camp, I'm going to yell at you some. Because I yell at you, everyone else is going to fall in a line. So I won't yell at you after that. I know I don't need to, but you understand, right?" And Russell's telling me the story. And so he says, "Yeah, Red, I know, it's fine." And then Russell's tagline when he tells the story was, "And every year, Red overdid it." then Bill will do his great cackle laugh. So for the people who watched, you know, Michael Jordan and Phil Jackson, The Last Dance, the smart NBA coaches with the great, great player make it a partnership. It's not a command and control at all. They're partners. We're in it together. We're going to communicate and we're going to do it together. So that story has really stuck with me with Red Auerbach. I had a reputation as being a kind of authoritative guy, and he knew how to do it.
Yeah.
I was going to actually rewind it one bit. First ever UVA player in the drafted the NBA. Walk us through your NBA draft night. What was that like? You said you labeled it as a dream of yours to get into the NBA.
Yeah.
What was that night like?
Because Barry Parkhill got drafted in the first round, too.
Oh, right. But didn't go. He went to the NBA.
Didn't go, as did Gus. And so, here's the story. I was house-sitting a house out in the country. My good friend Frank Burkhead, who some of you know and remember, he and I were housemates in this house out in this professor's house out in the country. So I'm going to get drafted. I know I'm going to get drafted. I think in fairly high in the first round. That's the intel. But I don't know where. So I had $47 cash. So the local beer distributor at that time was Terry Sieg. So I go to who was a friend of mine, and I said to Terry, you know, the draft's you know, coming up. I'm going to have a party out in the country. We need some beer. How much beer can I buy from you for $47? And Terry said, a lot. So I got a lot more than $47. I have no idea what the beer costs, but I gave him the $47 and we had a lot of beer. So everyone came out, you know, all the coaches, all the teammates, the friends, and it was during the day. It wasn't on TV.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't on TV, and you waited for the phone to ring. So now there were a couple hundred people there, and it was a nice day, so they were outside. It was June in Charlottesville. And so the music, and I'm kind of like, you know, kind of keep it down a little bit. So it was Portland that calls on the phone. That's how I find out. So so I get to walk out with, you know, friends and say, you know, I just went to Portland. So
if your house sitting, how'd they have the number to the right phone to call you on?
Well, you know,
no cell phones.
No cell phones, landline. So that was the line. You know, I knew my agent had it. So
that's on the end.
That's awesome.
That must have been awesome.
So two NBA championships.
I want to know one thing, because I grew up like all of us watching basketball, you know, trying to be like guys like you, etc. But winning the world championship in the NBA, and just the elation, and it's so effing hard to do. I know, just like the NCAA championship, we talk about it all the time. What was the feeling like when you guys won one of the two times or both times? Was it just sheer like joy that I would always think it would be? Were you just going crazy, or?
Yeah, but you know, and for the people that watched the Last Dance, they got a sense for this too, and I can remember it pretty clearly. I'm not comparing myself to Michael Jordan, but I can remember the feeling. Before there's joy, it's just relief. Yeah. You're in such a pressure-packed situation. You just kind of just the sense of relief it's over and we got there and we did it before you start to feel like celebration. You're, you know, no matter how much you played or how little, just you're kind of emotionally tired and just like, yeah. Okay, and we did it. And then you get a pretty good celebration going, and then it's a hoot. And then you get to share it with, you know, in any kind of city, a couple hundred thousand of your best friends.
I was just going to ask you, what was the difference in the celebration from winning the ACC tournament and winning an NBA title?
Well, emotionally, none. You know, it was so cathartic for us to win the ACC championship, having never been there. And you just like, again, I can remember going back to our hotel and my family was there. I got to share with them. There was a girl I liked. She was there. They had a bonfire and everyone's kind of looking around like, what just happened? Did we just, really? Or is this what we're celebrating? It was, you know, a little closer knit, but, you know, we were just all so stunned and we weren't prepared, because why would we be prepared for that to happen? The NBA deal was just, you know, it's just a bigger playing field, more people around, just kind of the urban scene. But no better, I'm telling you. The ACC championship for Wahoos, you know, was as good as you could possibly feel.
Yeah. So really good career in the NBA. 8 years?
Yes.
Been a year in Spain, or part of a year in Spain.
Italy. Yeah.
Then you decided to come back and go to business school at Stanford?
Right.
What was that? How did you come to that decision?
My last year in Houston, where Ralph was my teammate, his rookie year, I actually started the first 17 games. And then by the end of the year, I was playing very little. And physically, I wasn't feeling quite as good. So the handwriting was, you know, on the wall in pretty large letters. So I ordered my GMAT study guide while I'm still playing for the Rockets. So this is March, April. We didn't make the playoffs that year. And I'm going to take the test now in June, thinking, yeah, I better get myself ready, because I don't know how much longer anybody's going to be willing to pay me. Turned out no one else was willing to pay me in the NBA after that year, but I did go get some lira after that. But I can remember, so my season finishes in April. I come back to Seattle, which is my off-season home, and I take the test in June. Now, I've studied for the test. I've been out of college for 8 years. And by the way, thanks to UVA, because I'm at Virginia. I don't know I'm ever going to apply to graduate business school or graduate school, period. But, you know, because I did go to UVA, I was prepared for this test, and I got in Harvard and Stanford graduate business school. So anyway, I'm taking the test 2 months removed from my, what turned out to be my last MBA season. And you have a, you know, a bathroom break. And I remember I'm taking the test at Seattle U, and I go and I'm kind of lined up there, and this guy beside me, he recognizes me and says, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Pal, same as you, man. You know, I'm taking the test. Let's go to graduate business school." So anyway, I took the test, started applying, but had a chance to go to Italy and make a little money before starting graduate school in the fall of 85.
How hard was it to study that many years later? I think it'd be incredibly hard for me.
I've never worked so hard. My first quarter, first two quarters at business school at Stanford. I'd never taken accounting. I'd never taken economics. So I was not just competing against extremely bright people, but people that had some of the course material before. So it was hard work, but it's exhilarating too, just to be there in that environment. And by the way, for any of us old jocks, you got to, you know, when no one will pay anymore, by definition, you're going to have to change gears. You're going to have to change careers.
Right.
And so going to graduate school for me, and I think for a lot of guys, is a really good way to, by definition, you're making a change and you get yourself trained and doing something else.
They probably didn't give you a scholarship either for graduate school, did they?
I did not miss any class at Stanford Business School, not a one, because I was writing that check every quarter. it was a big check.
How much were you able to save during your professional career?
You know, I was cheap, so I had some money, and I was able to buy a house in Menlo Park, California. It's a little one-story rambler house on Orange Avenue in Menlo Park, California. I bought it for $240,000 in 1985 when I went to business school, sold it after business school for $285,000. So that basically paid for my education. Thought I was a genius until some years later, I drove by, there's a for sale sign. So I called, how much that house sell? And again, it was a nothing house, but it was in Menlo Park. It was over $1 million. But anyway, I had some money saved. And so it was pleasant that way, where I was able to pay for my education and not get too uptight about paying the bills. But we didn't make that much money. I mean, God knows, relative to today.
Well, what was your thought process in business school in terms of coming afterwards, right? Because when you're an athlete, you have preseason, you have your season, you have first year's over, second year, third, then you get to go to the NBA. But were you focused on something like, I want to be in the front office?
I wasn't focused on it. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just thought, hey, let me go to the best possible school.
Yep.
You know, just try to figure out what it is I like. And I realized, partly because I made a little money, I did like investing. So I took a job with a firm I'd never heard of until I was a couple months at Stanford Business School, called Goldman Sachs. Literally, I never heard its name in my life. All of a sudden now everyone said, oh, Goldman Sachs. Well, I took a job there then midway through my second year of business school in San Francisco in the private wealth management, which was really more straight money management in those days. It was great training.
And you worked for Goldman for how long?
7 years. And I started in New York. We had to go through a 6-month training program. So that was the fall of 87. For people that follow the market or know market history, they'll remember October 19th, 1987 is the day the market went down 22%, the biggest fall of all time. Well, I'm a trainee on the floor, the trading floor of Goldman Sachs in New York. It was crazier than anything I've ever seen in sports. It was people just losing their minds.
What area were you in? Was that private client wealth, or was it?
It was the equity floor. So people are just, you know, terrified. They think a career's over. They've lost a big chunk of their savings. They don't know where it's going to go the next day. So, you know, I'm a trainee, and it's the 29th floor of the old building on 85 Broad Street in Southern Manhattan. So after this day is over, we all go into the conference room for the equity conference room. It's everybody. It's the traders. A lot of them are legendary people, for people to follow, you know, markets. And I'll give you a couple of names that people may or may not know, but one they may. So the one guy's a guy named Steve Einhorn, who was the strategist, and Steve, what does this mean for, you know, for the markets and for the economy and for the country? And he's just white as a sheet. I mean, just looks terrible, and says, can only mean one thing. It's the next depression. This has to portend a depression. Everyone's looking around going like, well, you know, my career's over here. My savings are gone. Wow, this is Steve Einhorn, who was, you know, a big deal on Wall Street.
Yeah.
Then the head of research at Goldman Sachs, a guy named Leon Cooperman, is still very famous because he's a hedge fund manager. And a lot of people know who he is. So Leon was head of research at Goldman Sachs then. And he gives this, you know, really, again, negative thing. So then any questions? And somebody raises their hand. And again, I'm a trainee. I don't even get a seat. We're all just packed in this room. And somebody said, Leon, we're down 22% today. Huge discount. Isn't there anything we should be buying, you know, tomorrow, just after this huge discount? And Leon says, yes, there is one thing. Now it's like the old E.F. Hutton commercial. Remember? Everyone would lean in to hear what he was. Okay, because whatever Leon says, that one thing, we're buying it tomorrow. And I'm a trainee. I'm buying it tomorrow. And Leon says, with a straight face, he looks at everybody and says, the one thing you should buy tomorrow, canned goods. Well, the place went completely quiet. I mean, everyone has no sense of humor for about 2 seconds. Then Leon says, it's a joke. So then the place just erupted into like, oh, someone told me. So it was like a laughing, just a relief laughter. So anyway, but I'm telling you more about the market. Maybe Virginia basketball fans care to, maybe some will. But the next morning, the market goes straight down again. And so the Federal Reserve came in and flooded with liquidity, and the banks got involved because we thought it went straight down. It was going to go down to God knows what. But then it bounced back and it was fine. And I ended up having a career at Goldman Sachs.
And then when did you get the call to become a GM, president GM from Akron?
Yeah. So after my 7 years at Goldman Sachs, I decided to go out on my own. I started a money management firm in San Francisco, cleverly called Walker Capital. So I opened that first Monday of April of 1994. Now, the previous 2 years, I'd done the color on some of the Sonic broadcasts. I'm working at Goldman, so I can't do all of them. But I've got clients in Seattle, so I'm driving, so I'm flying to Seattle. I do some games in Seattle, but I meet the team on the road a lot, because I can combine it with my Goldman business. So anyway, I've done over 2 years, probably 90. So I've been around the team. I've done 90 games or so. So I know the team some, but you know, I'm not on the inside. I'm not, you know, making decisions by any means. So I had my money management firm open less than 2 months. And Bill Ackerley, who was the son of the owner, calls me, and I've known him a little bit, but not really. And he says, do you have any interest in talking to us about a front office position? And I said, well, I just started this money management firm. So I feel an affiliation for the organization after doing a broadcast and playing there 5 years, but no, I have no interest in working full-time for the organization. I want to run my money management firm. So anyway, that resulted in me taking a job as a consultant because they didn't have a general manager. The general manager left to take a job with the Blazers, a guy named Bob Whitsitt. So I said, still, I'm a no, but the draft is coming up. This was May. This was May of 1994. The draft is June. I'll help you temporarily. And if you want me to talk to anybody about being the next GM, maybe I know him, maybe I don't, but I'm happy to help. Well, it was a classic human nature reaction. They didn't say this, but this is my interpretation. Because I said no, they decided, hey, we got to have that guy.
Yeah.
So yeah. Another story is this. So I'm about to turn 40 years old in July of 1994. A woman I'm going out with, who's now my wife, who just came by, I just gave her a wave saying, no, I'm on with you guys, is taking me to Maui. Isn't that nice? She's taking me to Maui for my 40th birthday. So I say to her, you know, Linda, you know, and we're not engaged, but there's an addendum to the story. You know, these people have been nice to me. I respect them, but I need to go down up there and have a face-to-face with them to say I'm not taking, because they haven't interviewed anybody else for the GM job. To tell them face-to-face, I'm not your guy. I'm running Walker Capital, and that's my name's in the door, and that's what I'm doing. So I'm coming back, and we'll go straight to Maui. So I fly up, I think it's a Tuesday, I sit down with the owner and his son. Barry Ackerlund, Bill Ackerlund. And Barry gives me a hypothetical, like, what would it take, you know, for you to be interested in being our front office guy, GM? And I'm like, well, I don't think anything. He said, well, hypothetically. So, well, I'd have to have equity in the team because I just started my own money management firm. And I did that because I wanted to build equity in my own company. And what I think I'm doing is giving him a face-saving way to say, no, we can't do that. You know, we're closely held. It was a public company. I think that's what I'm doing. I'm not negotiating whatsoever. And he says to me, let me sleep on that. I'm thinking, sleep on that? What just happened here?
You're like, I'm coming here to say no.
Yeah, I thought I'm saving no. I'm saying no. So anyway, I called Linda that night, and she starts to have the conversation with, oh, how did they take it? Were they okay? I said, I might have taken the job. She's like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? So anyway, I went the next morning and I have a meeting. And obviously now Barry says, well, we started drawing up a contract. You got, you know, X percent of the team and then we'll get the salary. And like, so I ended up signing a deal that morning. Leaving that afternoon to get on a plane to go meet Linda in the San Francisco airport. We fly to Maui. So we get to Maui. Now she's like, wait a minute. You're moving. She's living in Palo Alto. You're leaving. You're taking a new job. What about us? So I propose. So you know, so in a 3-day span, I turned 40, took a new job, changed locale, and got engaged. So anyway, that's what happened. So
you kind of got reverse psychology like twice in 48 hours.
I used to get all these calls. You guys know a lot of people think they want to be in the front office, and some legitimately do, but loving sports isn't a good enough reason. But they would call me and say, you know, how do I get my start? And I would jokingly say, although they didn't think it was very funny, I think, I said, well, here's what you do. You take another job and you sit in your office and then just wait for the phone to ring for somebody to offer you a job. That's how I do. Again, not too much laughter from them. But anyway, the end of all that was I put myself in a position to be around the game again by doing the broadcasts. Right. And then when the opportunity came up, they at least knew who I was. And that's how it happened.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, you made some great trades and great acquisitions while you were at Seattle. And you guys had incredibly successful seasons. But you also had some really unique teams, too, with guys like Gary Payton and Sean Kemp. What was it like having them under you?
You know, great in the sense that they were really talented players. Tricky at times. Gary, you always knew, was a great, great competitor. When I got there in 94, Gary had never made an all-star team. And the team at large part of the reason why the front office changes made, that was 94 was the year that Seattle was the first number one seed to lose to an 8 seed in the playoffs. You know, Denver beat Seattle and it's a huge upset. Yeah, bingo. So anyway, there was a lot of turmoil around that. And so Gary, I'd been watching him. I'd done his games when he was at Oregon State when I was doing the Pac-10 games. There was a Pac-10 before Pac-12. And so I respect for his, you know, his grit and how tough he was, but he really wasn't that good offensively. He was good. I mean, he could score. He could really finish. And he had a post-up game, but inconsistent. So anyway, but I knew his game. I knew all their games. And Kemp, I thought, was just the next guy. He was so talented and powerful and quick. You know, his personal habits just should have been better, could have been better. But, you know, he and I could talk. We had a nice relationship. Well, we lose again in the first round of the playoffs in 95 with a team that won 57 games. So we were good. We didn't win the division that year. So now at the end of the 95 season, it's, you know, get rid of the coach. You got to get rid of either Payton or Kemp. And I'm 1 year as a GM, and I'm thinking, you know, these guys, we need to tweak it some. Our coach, George Carl, and our shooting guard, Kendall Gill, got into it publicly all year. It was ugly. It's a Sports Illustrated story. You know, it was ridiculous on both their parts. But anyway, I had to kind of navigate that, if not mediate it. So we had to move Kendall at the end of that year. The bottom line was we had a really talented team, terrible chemistry, and we didn't have enough outside shooting. So I was able to make a trade for Hersey Hawkins, and David Wingate for Kendall Gill. Now, Hersey Hawkins turns out to be the best guy ever and could really shoot the ball. He was an undersized two, but just fit in perfectly. David Wingate gave us something we didn't have before. Anyway, the next season, and for the people who watched the Last Dance, we end up, you know, winning 64 games. At that time, it was the 10th best regular season record of all time. We play the Bulls in the finals. Now, as a Seattle-centric guy, I'm sensitive how we were characterized in the Last Dance, because at one point they got Bob Costas saying, you know, they are these maybe the biggest underdogs in a long time in the NBA Finals. Well, then they put up the graphic where the Bulls only lost 13 combined regular season and playoff games that year. We, Seattle, the Sonics, had beaten them three of those 13. We beat them in the regular season, and we beat them twice in the finals. So we had a great, great team. In a normal year, if we're not playing arguably the greatest team of all time, the 95-96 Bulls, that team would have been a championship team. But we did play the Bulls and lost. What happened after that is unfortunate for Sonics, for fans, but really for Sean himself. Sean got sideways on his contract, and Gary was a free agent, so he got a big contract and deserved it. But Sean was tied up in his contract for two more years, but he let it bother him so much, and then he gained weight. So his game went down. In the 96 finals, Sean Kemp, next to Jordan, was the best player on the floor. As great as Pippen was, as great as Peyton was, and there were a bunch of Hall of Famers out there. Rodman was out there. Sean was fantastic. But then a year later, you know, we move him. But we did win the division three straight years. We're playing against Kobe and Shaq in the Pacific. Two straight years we win the division, even with Kobe and Shaq in L.A. So we had a great run.
The piece of the Last Dance, I remember playing against Gary Payton, I don't know, in high school or some national tournament or whatever, and he was just like a big trash talker, right?
So still was.
Yeah. The piece of the Last Dance where Jordan starts talking about how Gary Payton, where they show Gary Payton making the comments that he was tiring Jordan out.
Yeah.
Did you watch that? Where
I would start laughing, yeah. Yeah. Well, let me tell you something about Gary in that final series, though, because they made some reference to it. Gary did talk, and Michael's not the right guy to talk to, which he did a little bit in the series. So, Gary, we're all looking like, Gary, no, don't do it. not him. But Gary tore his calf muscle. We had a really tough Western Conference final against the Utah Jazz. That's Stockton Malone. Went to the finals the subsequent 2 years. Gary tears his calf muscle, which if you guys have ever done that, I've done that. Really, really hurts. You can play with it, but it's really debilitating. So there's a meeting before we start the finals against the Bulls. It's Gary's agent, Gary, our team doctor, and me. Gary's a free agent at the end of the year, so he's got a lot of money on the line. And the doctor says to him, Gary, this is a bad tear. It's going to bother you. I'll do the best I can taping it up, but it's not going to heal on its own until after, you know, you just sit down for a while. And Gary says, can I damage it any further? And the doctor says, I don't think so. It's a bad tear. It's just going to be excruciatingly painful for you. And Gary looked at his agent, looked at me and said, yeah, I'm playing. I'm in. So they taped him up. You would never know he was hurt by the way he played, but he really did have kind of a bad calf tear there and still did what he did. So he was legitimately a tough, tough guy.
Yeah. Out of all the jobs you've had, right, and all of them you were very successful, NBA player, business school and working for Goldman, starting your own company, president and GM, what did you enjoy the most?
Well, the best job in the world is being an NBA player. I've enjoyed all my jobs. Again, I've been so lucky, and I still like coming to work every day. I'm running a money management firm now. And but I hope, you know, Ty knows, and the other guys, UVA guy, all our friends know how fortunate they are. I think they do. But to do what you love and to compete at the highest level, even if you didn't get paid well, and you do – and by the way, as have your summers off too, let's throw that in the mix, is just, you know, how can you have a better job than that? So it doesn't last forever. So those guys, Ty et al., and I hope Kyle has a long run, and DeAndre almost by definition will. You know, it's not that you won't enjoy what you're doing after that. If you do it right, you can and will. But, man, it's a great job.
Do you have a preferred era of the NBA for yourself? Whether guys before you or your time? You know, like I pressed pause in 1993 on NCAA basketball. So that was my favorite era. do you like the game the way it is now?
I think anytime guys were wearing short shorts, they were the best ever.
That's a telltale sign.
That was my era. My kids, I've got kids now, they cringe. Like, Dad, really? Everyone was wearing them. And then I tell them they're coming back, and they're not buying that. But, we did wear the short shorts. You know, I think the NBA game, it's different, way different than when I played. In fact, I look back at our games, and you realize 10 guys are all kind of packed in around the key. Now with the spacing, I think it's a more attractive game. I'd like a little less three-point emphasis just because, you know, you can't just take a three every time down. I'd like to be a little more variety. But having said that, I think the players are better than ever. I think the game is better than ever. The spacing allows talented players to really show what they have. I think it's never been better.
And bringing it back to UVA during your career, did you watch UVA from afar? Were you a fan? Because I remember your name coming up in a few of these coaching searches. You know, was that ever an option for you to come back to UVA and look at that as, I don't know, destination?
Not in coaching. I did get a call in 01 about the AD job when Terry retired. I just come off. I was on the board of visitors at UVA, which was a great honor. And my tenure just ended there right at the time Terry was leaving as athletic director. So Leonard Sanders did call me. But my group had just bought the Sonics, I mean, a month before that. Right. So I committed to friends and investors and was going to take over the business side with the Sonics. So it wasn't the right time for me. And I said to Leonard Sanders when he called me, and Leonard's one of the great guys around the university that some people know, I said, I think you got a great guy sitting right there in Craig Littlepage. And Craig Littlepage didn't get hired as the AD because I said it, but a lot of other people were saying it. And he was a great AD for us. So thankfully, that's the direction that the school went. But again, then in 09, I did get a call from John Oliver. John said, I'm coming through Seattle. Now, the previous coaching hire hadn't worked out that well. I don't know this for sure. And I'm speaking way out of school when I say this, but Paul Tudor Jones, you know, put up the money for the arena, the lion's share of it, thankfully. Thank you, Paul, again. And he was engaged. He wasn't going to make a decision, but he was engaged in making sure we got the right coach. I think he said to John and Craig, let's enlist some of our guys that may have an opinion, may know something about some of the coaches. So, again, that's speculation on my part because it was never said. But John came out to Seattle, and we spent a long time talking. We spent a whole morning talking about candidates. Well, ironically, living in Seattle, I'd just gone 2 weeks before John came out to see Washington State play at University of Washington. So I'd seen Washington State play, and I'm sitting there with my son, who, by the way, subsequently went to UVA. And we're sitting there watching the game, and I say to him at one point, this is one of the least talented teams I've ever seen in Division I basketball. Talking about Washington State, and I'm Tony's sitting right across from me. I'm thinking, this guy is really good because these guys have no talent. They had won some talent. Clay Thompson was there. But the rest of, you know, anyway. So I concluded, and I watched him on TV some, that one, that guy was a really good coach. Well, then when John Oliver and I were talking about candidates, we kind of said, Tony Bennett, well, nah, he's turned down Indiana. There's no chance. That's never going to happen. You know, so he's going to stay in Washington State. He's obviously committed to there. So fast forward a couple of weeks, and now John and I have a regular dialogue. And of course, he's doing a lot of legwork. Craig's ultimately going to make a decision through the normal channels. So it's Tubby Smith. John's coming, and I know Tubby a little bit. I have great respect for him, and everyone, the fans are all worked up about Tubby Smith because of his resume. And okay, so Tubby's he's a fine guy. We can get him, great. So John then calls and says, something's amiss with the negotiation with Tubby, and I just got a call that Tony Bennett's interested. I said, you're kidding me. Tony Bennett is interested? You got a shot at that guy? He said, yeah. Well, it turns out it was Richie McKay that called to say, you know, you might want to. And I'm like, well, hell yes. You know, from what I know, and I knew some people who know Tony, although I did not, he'd be a perfect fit. So, listen, those guys got the deal done, John and Craig, and you know, brilliant hire, best all time. Yeah. So all credit to them. But you guys might remember. So Tony gets hired, and because people had Tubby in their mind or whomever else it got rumored, it wasn't a
Phil Jackson. Phil Jackson. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, right. it wasn't a popular choice. So I get the call from the SID at Virginia. Would you take some of these calls? We're getting some negative reaction to Tony Bennett, and you're out there and you've seen him. I said, yeah, I'm happy to. So I get a bunch of calls from guys mostly in state about this hire. The kind of question along the lines are, you know, what about the style? How's the style? I can remember my answer. I remember these calls. I said, how do you feel about winning as a style? Is that a good style for us? I said, have you watched Memphis? Because Calipari is a Memphis. And, you know, I can't remember what year he went to Kentucky, but they were scoring in the 60s. You know, that seemed to work for them. And what about recruiting? You know, he's a West Coast guy. My answer was, have you ever been to Pullman, Washington? He recruited the Pullman, Washington for 6 years, both as an assistant and as a head coach.
Right.
With a good program, you know, let's not worry about that. So anyway, I still hadn't met Tony, still hadn't talked to him, but Tony remembers. He remembers everything. He remembered that I said those things. And in the meantime, we had a guy named Bob Weiss, who'd been a longtime assistant, longtime head coach in the NBA, including for us in Seattle. Mm-hmm. Bob, in an off year, had done the color for the Washington State games. So I called him. I said, Bob, you watch firsthand, you know, Tony Bennett. What do you think? He says, oh man, that guy, he's fantastic. He was succeeded at any level. I felt completely confident in saying what I was saying. And Bob Weiss, of course, had coached since the earth had cooled. So he knew.
That is awesome. Yeah. I mean, when I first met Ronnie and Coach Bennett and staff, I think it was their first year when they came up to play Seattle. We were in there was this alumni meeting thing, meet the coaching staff and players, and there was like, because we were terrible, there was like three people there and I was one of them. But like, I'm on the East Coast now, I'm in Oakland, and I watched those Washington State games, and I remember telling my brother, because I'm a junkie, I watch at night, and I'm like, you gotta watch this Washington State team, like the way they play, they're really good. And he was like, we watched them in the tournament, and he was like, yeah man, I wish Virginia played like that. And like, not knowing anything. And I remember when we got him, I'm like, that's the dude we were talking about in the tournament 2 years ago. And I told that story to Ronnie and them. And I think that's one of the reasons why they like me, because I was telling them that story. But,
well, it's so nice. It's so nice to have a system where everyone has to react to you. And you know, everyone's going to hate playing us even before we were any good.
Right.
Before Tony got, you know, the classes recruited that he did, you know, everyone hated the playing against us. And, you know, can you rely every year, like some programs have made themselves out to be, to out-recruit Duke, North Carolina, Kentucky? Well, that's a recipe for failure. And if you have a system that you can, you know, hang your hat on, and, you know, that's, of course, now we can recruit too, because we got the facilities and we got the legacy and the tradition. Yeah. And thank God for Ty and his group. And here we go. But until you came in with what Tony could bring, we were going nowhere.
I have one question left before TW takes over and goes through his Image React series with you.
Okay.
The guys who were the star players in the 70s, how do you see them fitting in and performing in today's game on the college level? So if you were playing at UVA now, how do you think you would do?
I would do fine. Because I actually really get jealous of the guys the way this game's played now, because one, we couldn't dunk. I could really jump. We couldn't dunk, and we didn't have the 3-point shot when I played. Even the closer in one, or one that got moved out, you know, subsequently. But the way I played, which was more, you know, both slashing and shooting the ball and shooting the ball deep. I would love to play where they're playing now. And I was athletic enough. The best guy I ever played against in college, I think maybe the best college player of all time. And some people remember him, some people don't. It's a shame there's not more video of him. David Thompson was incredible. Oh, yes. Was incredible. Yeah. I mean, the ACC, we only had seven teams when I'm there. But, you know, it was the fifth pick in the draft. But every year there were guys, almost three or four guys in the top 10, always in the top couple. John Lucas from Maryland was the number one pick, you know, my year. And I'm fifth. And Kupchak is, I think, 12. So, anyway, it was like that every year. And David Thompson was so much better than anybody else. It was a joke. And he was just, you know, so great. You know, Walter Davis ended up being rookie of the year. Phil Ford, those are my guys. So, you know, they would adapt, and they were athletic enough. Now with the training and specifically the weight training and nutrition, yeah. Guys would have been just fine. The game, when I see it now, and, you know, it does look slow to me, our vintage. And that's just some kind of everyone was, you know, the same. But the athletic guys would have been just fine.
T Dubs, you ready?
Yeah,
take it away.
So, you know, I don't know if you've seen some of these, but we generally show you an image, and we just kind of want to get your reaction to it.
Worship
impression. All right. Yeah. So here's the first one. This is you cutting down the nets.
Pure joy. By the way, I'm on a guy's shoulders, and I'm sorry I don't know his name, because every once in a while I'm back for a game every couple of years, and he taps me on the shoulder and said, you were on my shoulders for like 20 minutes and I survived. Fortunately, he's a big guy and he's doing fine still, but I was on his shoulders forever.
What do you remember about obviously we won one recently, but up until then you were it. You were the only, I mean, that was still, when I was a kid, it was all about the legend of Wonderful Wall. Like what do you remember about that?
Yeah, I referenced it before. All you got to do is look at the faces, not just mine.
Right.
look at everybody's. I mean, pure joy, pure – I used the word before, too, catharsis. I mean, it's like all those bad losses, all those coulda, woulda, shoulda that, you know, everyone has a little bit. If you follow sports, there's always one to get away. But all of a sudden, we've done it. We'd won it.
Finally.
Championship. So just to have that, and I talked about relief before, but – This wasn't relief because it was unexpected. This was pure joy.
I was born in 77, and my parents always joked that I was the reason why we never won again until Joe Harris hit the three. They always said, it's because of you. Once you were born, we never won again. I'm like, great. And then this is the next one. Oh, go ahead. The next one is Barry Parkhill.
Look at that stud.
Barry Parkhill, Tops, Virginia Squires. I was going to ask about ABA versus NBA. At that time, like, what were your thoughts on the two different leagues?
Well, I loved them both. The ABA was really exciting, and we used to go down once in a while to see Barry and watch the Squires play. A three-hour drive we'd make and load up the car and go down. You know, the year I came out of Virginia, it was the year the leagues folded, or the ABA folded and the leagues merged.
Right.
So – you know, I love the fact there were two leagues until there weren't, because of course that helped our negotiating position when we were playing. So bottom line, Barry was a just great teammate, great guy, still is, of course, and people know him, and he helped me a lot.
He helped us get the word over to you, so we always appreciate
that's him, and that's what he does.
And then here's the next one. We didn't talk about the actual – you won the ACC tournament. This is the 1976 bracket in our East region up here, Virginia, right at the top. What do you remember about that tournament after winning the tournament, the ACC tournament, going into that?
Yeah.
What was that like?
Well, we were still a little too full of ourselves, I think, about what had happened the weekend before, because we really had an opportunity there. If we would have beat DePaul – we would have gotten VMI in the next round, who also upset Tennessee. We'd already beaten VMI in the regular season. You know, they were good. Bill Blair, the coach, is a friend of mine. You know, one, the game against DePaul, this sounds like an excuse, and I hate to even make it sound like one. I did have a flu. I'm sorry I did, because I, you know, I didn't have my best game. I mean, listen, in a season when our margin for error wasn't very big, and I averaged a third of our points. I averaged 22. We averaged, I think, 65, 66 points a game. I couldn't score 11 points and us win an NCAA in a tournament game. So I wish I'd, you know, been healthy. I wish I'd played better.
So do you remember the score in that game?
What's that?
Sorry, T-Dubs. Do you remember the score in that game?
I don't remember the score. We were up at halftime, and we just we languished the second half. They had a guy named Ron Norwood. He was a good player. Might have played briefly. And Dave Corzine played in the NBA. Ron Norwood got hot, and we were done.
I was going to say, when you started, so you the ACC tournament ends, what point were you starting to feel the effects of the flu before this game? Like when you traveled, before?
Not till midweek. We started practicing. In hindsight, we should have taken one less day off. I think Coach Holland was saying, you guys earn a few days off. We didn't come back to practice until Wednesday after winning the tournament on a Saturday. We should have come back on Tuesday and just eased into it more. So I remember by Thursday I was feeling it. So I had something.
And then I'm sure there are a lot of fans that are like, what?
Anyway. Is that VMI? VMI, one game out of the Final Four, huh?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah, we would end up – Rutgers was the power in the East at that point. Yeah. That would have been a hard game for us, but they wouldn't have liked playing against us because of our style. Their star players were actually one guy, Jam James Bailey, and I were teammates for the Sonics after that too. But we would have had to play really well to win that one. But we could have gotten to the Elite Eight. We should have.
And then Indiana, obviously winning it all.
Well, that's the last undefeated team in college basketball, and those guys are my buddies. I just saw Quinn Buckner. In fact, he was in the Last Dance, got some airtime. But that was Kent Benson. Scott May was a college player of the year. So that was a great, great team. I don't think we could have beaten them.
Yeah, that team of destiny.
Yeah.
And then here in the locker room.
Yeah, I guess we're Portland. Past the elite stage already. That's Herm Gilliam, who may rest in peace, is gone. Larry Steele is dumping stuff on his head. that was a happy locker room. That's the home game, and of course the city of Portland just went crazy after that.
I was going to say, compare winning as a part of an NBA team versus leading the charge in the AC tournament. What was the difference in emotion for you personally?
Well, it was very, very similar. The only difference for me was, and it's a huge difference, is the emotional impact of having won it with Virginia. Not as big a stage as winning the NBA title, but emotionally bigger for me because being there the 4 years and feeling so loyal to, you know, what university and our group of coaches and players have gone through, there'd be nothing that can equal that.
And then what about with the Sonics? I mean, you mentioned a sigh of relief, but you've got three like in such a close span of incredible highs. What about the comparison?
Yeah, Sonic one was relief for a while because we lost the game 7 the year before. We lost game 1 there. We came into that season with expectation to win the championship. So we had to win a game 7. We had to win a game 6 elimination game at Phoenix in the Western Conference Finals. That was a relief. And then we had to win game 7 back in Seattle to get to the finals. So that was a relief. So we were just, you know, taking them on one by one. But had we not won a championship that year in Seattle, that would have been a huge disappointment. So it was relief for a longer period of time before we got to, you know, this.
And then Garrett.
Yeah, Shorts, nice stash too, huh?
Yeah, man.
Every time I get about 3 of these cards a month. People want, I don't even want them to tell me how much or how little they pay on eBay. but I sign them, I send them back. But I think every time, you know, couldn't they have gotten a little better action shot than that?
I mean, really? I think that's warm ups.
Yeah, well, kind of. I mean, that's my friend Fred Brown in the background. I stay in touch with Fred. He lives here in Seattle, too.
Downtown Freddie Brown.
Downtown Freddie Brown. That's him.
That is awesome. So cool. And then this next one, Dr. J. I would say, yeah. Barry told us some Dr. J stories. I wonder if you in the finals, obviously, what was a memory for you when you see some
picture? Yeah, well, you know, one, he was fantastic in that finals. In fact, I just saw Bill Walton quoted as saying, I forget what it was. It was ESPN 30 for 30, that Bobby Gross, the guy I backed up, outplayed Dr. J in the finals. No, he didn't. Bill, what are you – were you even there? And Dr. J was interviewed saying, like, no. Anyway, Bobby Gross was a good player, a good blend player, and played well. But Dr. J was incredible in the finals. He threw down, of course, like he was. Now, so fast forward a couple years past that, and now I'm playing more. I'm in the rotation, and then 2 years in the NBA, I was a starter. You know, he's my matchup. So I would say this about when I guarded Dr. J. He was always open for a jump shot because I was so far off of him. He had a 6 for 27 night against me because he was open and I you know, go ahead, Doc. Some nights he made them, but he was. And by the way, I stayed on his right hand. I was playing for the Rockets, and I got booed on my own home court 1 year because he had a breakaway, and I just jumped in front of on his right hand and stopped him. The fans are all on their feet ready to see Dr. J dunk. And I was like, no, you're not going right to be a dunk.
And then this is, you know, this next image. Oh. We're going to ask you, obviously you were not there on the team, obviously, but when Chaminade beat UVA, what were your thoughts? Did you hear it in the locker room? Did you?
No, I tell you exactly where I was. I was in Seattle. I was playing for the Houston Rockets. But we played in the Northwest right before Christmas. So I went home to Seattle for Christmas. And Christmas morning, I got up. No internet, obviously. I didn't know what happened in the game. So I didn't know. So I picked up the newspaper because it was late night because the West Coast time.
Right.
It was Christmas morning. I'm pretty sure it was Christmas. That was the 24th. And I'm back in Seattle before going back to play for the Rockets and saw the score. And like every other Wahoo fan, you know, could not believe what I was reading.
Did you talk to anyone? Do you have any relationship with anyone on the team that you were able to pick up the phone and ask or
call
anyone?
Well, Frank Burkhead would have been my go-to. I'm sure I called him. Like, are you kidding me? Because he of course, was really close to Coach Holland. And I don't think he was on the trip because they went Tokyo back to through Hawaii.
Right, Tokyo home.
But yeah, what a shock!
And here's Wally Walker Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that's my son who at that stage didn't know he was going to be a Wahoo too, and I keep this picture in a treasure place in our home. And he just got his name is Joe. He just graduated from got his master's of Pepperdine after graduating from UVA in 2018, and just got a job. So nice. He's got a marker. We're very proud of him.
And what was his? I mean, your name's plastered all over JPJ. Your face. What were his thoughts going there and seeing that?
You know, I tended not to ask because I have season tickets. So he would go use the tickets. Well, not all the time, but some. I think he appreciated those. But I know recently a friend of mine. I think it was during the Final Four because he went with me to Minneapolis to the Final Four, and I was there with some physical friends of mine. They were kind of like, you know, Joe, how was it? And he said, you know, honestly, Dad played there so long ago, you know, no one remembered him.
Yeah, right.
So it didn't really come up. So, okay, yeah, great. It makes me feel good.
And then we always ask this just because that Playboy article where Jordan said, oh, yeah, I wanted to go play with Ralph Sampson. Back in the day, but they never recruited me. What are your fresh impressions of seeing him in a Virginia uniform?
Well, I don't know if I buy that one. Did I lose you guys? I can't see anybody right now.
We're on the right. I don't know. It's because I'm sharing the screen, I think.
Oh, okay, good. You know, would Michael Jordan have left North Carolina to come to Virginia back in those days? I don't know. That could be some revisionist history. That's what struck me. I would have liked to have seen him. I would like to have seen that combo. you know, I know Michael some. I've known him a little bit over the years. Yeah, that would have been just fine, but I'm not sure I'd buy it.
I think we did lose you, your video, maybe. Sorry. And then, as long as you can you still see the screen?
I don't see anything on the screen. My screen has gone dark. I wonder. Yeah.
Let's see. Video, maybe? Let me see.
I don't have any prompt.
Here we go.
Oh, there we go. We can see you now.
Okay, I don't see anything. So, but I don't care as long as you guys get what you need.
So this next image is Sonics jerseys on Russell Westbrook, Kevin Durant, James Harden.
Yeah, that's still raw around here and raw in my household. you know, the team got sold in 2006. I was the CEO of the company. I was a member of the 9-man board, and we had a vote. The vote was 5-4 to sell to the guys from Oklahoma City. I'm one of the 4 no votes, which no one knew at the time. And I had to read people being critical of me when I knew I'd voted no, but I knew why people were upset. Same reason I was upset, because I didn't believe the guys when they said they were going to try to keep a team in Seattle, but 5 of our board members did believe it. And, the fact that they then, of course, moved the team 2 years ago. I know more about this, and I wish I did, because there was a lawsuit, and I testified in court about the fact that I just wanted the guys from Oklahoma City to do what they said they do, use good faith, best efforts to keep the team in Seattle. So they didn't do that. They moved the team to Oklahoma City, and we're working. Let me turn the page then after that to say, we are working still, and our group guys have bought the Sacramento Kings in 2013. We're going to move it to here, but it required NBA approval for the move, and we lost that vote. We thought we had it until we didn't. So we're still working, and we just need to get an arena deal that will work, and the NBA will be back here, but just has taken way too long.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a storied franchise, and you guys still have the rights to the Supersonics, right? When it comes, it still will be the Supersonics. Is that right?
The only thing the city did right in negotiation with Oklahoma City and their group when they moved it was to retain the rights to the name. So I guess it's possible that a new owner will want a different name, but it's so beloved and branded here in this city.
I can't imagine someone would do that.
Yeah, that would be crazy. So I think we'll have a Seattle Supersonics again at some point.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
This great, next image. Can you see this next image or no?
Sorry, guys, I can't see. All
okay, so next image is Pete Gillen, Pete Gillen coaching Keith Jennifer. But I was going to ask during this, you know, we call this like the lost generation of Virginia basketball, just because a lot of people for whatever reason don't think about it as much, especially now given the success. But what are your thoughts on it when you're during your time? In Virginia.
Yeah, we were hard to watch for a while, and JJ had it going for a while. We made the Elite Eight, and of course he being an alum, I tracked him and a friend. So, and then I think a lot of us, although I was on the board when Pete Gillen got hired, so indirectly I knew what was going on, but I think there was a disconnect, not just because the team wasn't as successful, but I think. Prior to that and after that with Tony, alums are made to feel as if, we're still part of it. And that's important because it's gives you a family feel and goes a long way to the emotional link that we probably have anyway, but it really does. It really is a nice thing for us.
It's one of the things you made me think about talking about Mr. Burkhead over and over today. He was at our practice probably twice a week. A stupid example, right? And open door policy and great guy, special to all of us.
He was such a connector. I'm sure you guys, we all have friends like that. But until he was gone, I didn't realize, I think it goes for a lot of our mutual friends, how much he did to keep us all together. And we still honor him. Before the alumni game, the last game this year, which I came back for, the Florida State game, no, Louisville game.
Yeah, Louisville. I saw you there.
Game. We did a little pregame brunch at Jackie, his widow's home, and a lot of the guys showed up. Coach Holland was there, so you know Frank will always be in our memories and honored, and he should be.
That's great.
This next image is an old Tony Bennett, nobody does it better image from his old videos. But just wanted to get your thought. I mean, we already kind of went over this, but when Tony gets hired, he comes in, like you're obviously a fan of him, but as he's been building this thing, like what has your relationship been with him over these years?
Yeah, we do stay in touch, and I talk to him intermittently and try not to pester him too much during the season, but I text with him a reasonable amount. We played golf. We actually went to Augusta. That was a nice trip. That was I guess a couple years ago, and I can remember, Mark, you may appreciate this, and it was right after the guys transferred, and Ty and Kyle are just coming off their freshman year, and Tony being Tony, you know, he doesn't think he has all the answers, and even though he has most of them, says to me, you know, what do you think? You know, it always hurts when a guy transfers because, you know, he's been with you. And I told him exactly what I thought, which is that opens up playing time for your two freshman guards. From what I've seen, you know, they're ready to help you and, you know, they'll flourish. And boy, did they. So anyway, he's always curious. And, you know, there's so many great qualities. And if there's ever been a perfect fit for any university, for any position, it's Tony Bennett as the head basketball coach at the University of Virginia. And listen, I get a call most years from an NBA old friend about, you know, whether he should go, whether he'd be interested in going to the NBA. And I don't know that he won't be, but he's in the perfect place for him. And he's asked me a couple times over the years, and there are just so few good situations in the NBA that he needs to stay at Virginia for the rest of his coaching career, and he'll be a Hall of Famer. And I said this back in 2009, he could be Krzyzewski for us. He's got a few more titles, but that I don't want too much pressure on him, but you know, he's on his way.
I mean, you as an NBA, and this next image we have, perfect timing prior. This is James Harden rolled up shorts, trying to bring back the short shorts.
Yeah, those were the days. Again, I'll harken back to my kids' reaction, which is, you know, are you kidding me? And listen, I can remember saying we couldn't get them short enough or tight enough. And, you know, we take a size smaller just so we make sure we were fashionable, which, of course, are just disgusting when you see it now. But that was then.
And then this next picture is UMBC guy driving in, Maury taking a finger roll. Where were you when you, like, how did you watch that game? What were your thoughts after?
I was at the game. I had good seats, but then friends of mine had seats in the first row right behind our bench. And at halftime, they asked me to come down and join them, which I regret. Just, you know, was it my move? Is that what did it? But, you know, that game, for a whole host of reasons, was anomalous. I mean, I'm stating the obvious here. But there are a whole lot of things that don't get enough attention. You know, Mark and I talked about it last week when we talked. We got a terrible whistle. That's not an excuse for a one losing to a 16. But I was watching the guy, and he wanted to not call it the right way. That aside, we shouldn't have lost the game. DeAndre had played, we would have won the game. We weren't very versatile without him there. We could have gone to a small lineup and posted him up and made them pay for being small. We couldn't do that. But for Tony to use it the way he used it, to plant that seed, we're a team of destiny, couldn't have happened without losing that game. And I don't know, I mean, all of us have played in some way, shape, or form. If in the back of your mind, if you think you're a team of destiny and you got a tough shot from the corner to win or tie a game, or find the right guy to make the right assist pass for somebody to hit that three-point shot, if you think you're a team of destiny, you're going to make that shot. If you don't think that, maybe you do, but, you know, you may not. Well, him using that the way he did, and that's, it may sound a little cynical, but for as excruciating as it was for all of us, particularly Tony and the group, to make of it what he did is just is magic.
And that takes us perfectly. This next one, Tony Bennett holding the net and scissors, screaming after the Purdue win.
Yeah.
How about that game? Where were you? What were your thoughts?
I was in Seattle watching on TV. Knew I was going to the Final Four, hoping we would be there. But I can remember sitting there when the bank shot went in, thinking it was over.
Yep.
And I was watching by myself because I was bad company. I was at Seattle Tennis Club where they had a big – anyway, so no one was – you know, I had a big kind of aura around me, like, you know, don't talk to this guy. But I kind of remember thinking to myself, this is one of the best games I've ever seen in my life. And I've seen a lot of games. That it's a shame we have to lose it, but it's just an incredible all-time great basketball game. And then for us to win it the way we want it, and win it at all in an all-time great basketball game is just – I don't know how that happened.
And then we're almost done. Two more images. This second to last one, Minneapolis. You said you were there. This is a photo with a bunch of the alum, Malcolm, Dev, Roger Mason, Justin, Ralph, all hanging out. Where were you? What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I was sitting with my son, and then I rendezvoused. I was there with a bunch of business school classmates. I did go to a party, so I saw some of those guys, but I wish I'd known where they were. I would try, because I saw Ralph there. Of course, he and I stay in touch because we were teammates in Houston, and I see him, you know, most times when I go back. So, and I saw Joe before the game and Malcolm, but man, I missed that one. But listen, it speaks to, it is a family, and you know, Tony and success of the program, but the way he's done it, you know, really, really has driven that.
And you said you were going to go to the Final Four regardless, right? You already had it planned.
Yes. I was there with seven of my business school classmates, and one of our buddies lives in Minneapolis. So we were staying with him, and we were gonna all do it. And then I got extremely lucky.
That's incredible. And then here's the last one. You can't see it. This is all of the guys kneeling for injustice. This is – I want to say Ty's first year. London's in the picture. They're all wearing black at the V Saber, kneeling down. And given today, you know, the climate of today, and just so everyone knows, this is Monday. We had the tumultuous weekend of rioting. This seems more powerful now than ever, right? And what are your thoughts when you hear, obviously you're hearing this?
Yeah, well, we had huge riots in Seattle, and we're sitting here on TV watching it on Sunday and Monday nights, and many of the riot scenes are scenes I'm very familiar with. They're right in front of my old office. And so a couple of things, you know, come to mind. One, you know, I was in the NBA for 22 years, so, you know, I was with, you know, predominantly African-American sport. And I have so much respect for those people I travel with, and you know, who we sweat and add to joy and the opposite with. And I know most of those guys, if not all, at least most of them, at some point have expressed to me the issues they had with our law enforcement. And I'm thinking, these are the best people I know. And they had problems with law enforcement. So we have an issue there we have to get to. But we also need to do it in a way that Malcolm Brogdon, and when is there a time that Malcolm Brogdon doesn't make us all proud that he's a UVA guy? We have to do it in a nonviolent way, because what's transpired with the destruction hurts the very people that they allegedly are trying to help, because we can't have that enough, and we need strong voices, you know, saying that. But to honor what has happened and what needs to get changed, and a peaceful protest is what separates this country from all totalitarian countries and regimes. And so we can't suppress that. We just need to do it a little better than some did it this past weekend. That's how I see it.
I appreciate that. I know this is a difficult subject to discuss.
It is, but it's topical. We can't not discuss it.
Yeah.
either. So I from the quotes I've seen from Kyle and Tony Bennett, Malcolm, I think have done a great job of encapsulating how we all feel about the tragedy of Mr. Floyd and how wrong that was. And if we learn something and do it correctly and try to rectify it, then you know, then we've done something really important.
And one more, it's not an image, this is just a question in terms of you being the first to win the AC title and then Joe being Seattle guy, winning the ACC, you know, tournament title, MVP. What do you remember, where were you watching that game and your thoughts and connection with Joe?
I was watching from Seattle, I'd had a little interaction with Tony before that, that week. But Joe and I have been acquainted, and I still stay in touch with him some. I'm not sure he would be happy with saying he's a Seattle guy. He's from Chelan, which is one of the most beautiful little towns in the world. It's right on this Lake Chelan. It's an alpine lake that you have to see to believe how beautiful it is. But he does come through here. So I was so thrilled for him and for them. It was ridiculous. His success with the program has been, it took that many years before the second one occurred. When we did it, we thought, okay, and, you know, this will be the start of a lot. And then Ralph comes. But anyway, so glad now it's more of a habit than it is an exception. And I fully anticipate that to be the case going forward.
Yeah, definitely don't take that for granted. The fact that my entire adult life had never seen an ACC title until that one. So I always appreciate that one. And then, Dougie, your question?
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking about how to present it because, again, talking to you, Wally, and like all the guys that came before me and the legends, et cetera, I do a segment called Your Mount Rushmore of Virginia Basketball. But I'm going to change the rules with you as compared to usually. It's your own – your criteria, whoever you want to be your favorite guy, the best player, whatever. But I'm going to give you two. So you can do one from your era and before, and then after your era going forward, if that makes sense.
Yeah, okay. Well, for me, this is we already talked about him. Barry Parkhill got it started. I wouldn't have come to Virginia without him doing what he'd done. Forget about the recruiting part, coming up to see me. Just him being ACC Player of the Year and Virginia being ranked. Virginia was nowhere until Barry started. He was an All-American player, ACC Player of the Year. He got it going. Ralph, you know, I'm stating the obvious again. Maybe he's my era since we were teammates, but not my era of Virginia. But he's so far ahead of anybody else that – but I want to maybe change your rule for a second, Doug, because I want to go to the guy we talked about again briefly. Malcolm – to me, set a tone for the culture of the program. It just exemplified what Tony was trying to accomplish. Not highly recruited, just did it through hard work and becomes Defensive Player of the Year, ACC Player of the Year, First Team All-American from, you know, wherever he was recruited when everyone said, yeah, this guy, you know, he's okay. For him to develop that way and then his success as a pro, that now the program has something to point to say, you come here, you play for this guy in this facility, you can become an All-American and become an NBA starter and make a bunch of money. And why wouldn't you come here? So for us to be able to hang our hat on it, and then you have him being the kind of guy that he is that makes us proud for, you know, whatever he's doing on or off the court. I think that is definitely not my era, but I am so proud and I stay in touch with him and it's always a pleasure.
Yeah, two more.
Oh, I'm doing the five. Oh,
you get five. You get five. What do we have?
Okay. Well, you know, Brian Stith was just a great, great player. So, yes. You know, I gotta go with Brian. And I don't know who I'd pick. I think the three guys that just went to the pros last year, I'm gonna count them as one because you can't win a national championship and not have. Yeah, those three mentioned for what they accomplished and how they accomplished it. So they'll be a three-headed choice for me.
Great list. I love it.
Amazing.
It's a long, good list. It's a good list to choose from. So I'm sorry for those guys, great ones I've left
off. And you're a little more decisive than most people because a lot of times there's a 6-second rule. Well, actually, it should be a 5-second rule, right? If you don't get an answer out in 5 seconds, my face goes up on Mount Rushmore. And that's not good.
Yeah. Oh, come on, man. That's a deterrent.
that would just demolish your list. So.
Yeah.
Wally, you've been an incredible guest. We love having you on. It's such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Mark. I'm glad you guys are doing this.
Thank you so much.
Go Hoos. It's a great service. And of course, we all love the university and its programs and sports. So it doesn't get tired. We don't get tired. It doesn't get boring for any of us.
Yeah,
absolutely not.
For T-Dubs out in the West Coast, for Dougie Fresh in Jersey, I'm Mark Jerome. Don't forget, follow us on YouTube. Subscribe to us, Apple and Spotify. We're giving you locker room access. Catch you next time.
With a tomahawk slam. That's the winner here. On the front page, the tournament is about Diakite. Jerome off the glass.